In the second part of our startup stories in partnership with Baltic Ventures, Talk On To Walk On is once again delighted to share a conversational insight into the mindsets of impressive entrepreneurs. We have Rebecca Garcia of Cubode, who are making coding and data analysis much more accessible to small and medium-sized companies. Peter Lydon of Burl, tackling the environmental impact of the fashion industry by allowing customers with one click to trade in used clothing for credit on their favorite brand websites. And Paul Williams of Ittybit, who has created software that tackles problems such as uploading, storing, and converting video, audio, and image files at a massively reduced cost.
I care more about what I think. And if I am making decisions that fulfill me and make me happy, if I make mistakes, I learn. I'm only 30. Fundraising, it's like going to a club as a 17-year-old that has never been to a club. You know kind of like what you're looking for, but you don't know how it works. You have to go between vision and organizing the day-to-day and kind of like being an execution machine. But I do think the vision and setting up the time to share that vision with the rest of the team and other stakeholders constantly is much more important than I ever thought.
Actually, you know, you talked about skill set before. I think your moral set is probably the most important thing in terms of like you both got to agree what's right and what you're prepared to do and what you're not. So I guess my big frustration is all about people who say what they're going to do rather than talk about what they've done. There's always times we disagree, right? And I think it'd be wrong if we didn't, because we wouldn't really be that passionate about what we're doing if we just sort of let each other get on with it. The power of the team and the collective is amazing, really. You know, 10 people working together is like 100 people working apart, right?
You should hire people who are better than you, but you should also understand the job and understand the role. And yes, I think if you're not able to basically do a lot of things on your own, I think you'll really struggle. You shouldn't invest in somebody who needs the advice. Like, do you know what I mean? You're trying to find investments where, if I didn't invest, the founder would do this anyway. In terms of things that really impacted me in school, I was always entrepreneurial. I was the guy who would buy sweets at the store and sell them for a markup at lunch, right? Like that. I've always been like that.
Even if you think their business idea may not be directly relevant to you, their stories and mindset insights are definitely for everyone. You will also get to see our passion for business and why we have invested in the Baltic Ventures Tech Accelerator, and how the power of conversation and community created at Baltic Ventures has collectively provided these founders the courage and confidence to walk on towards their dreams. If you love what you hear and want to learn more about becoming an investor or applying for the next Baltic Ventures cohort, go to balticventures.uk. If you want to learn more or connect with any of the brilliant businesses featured in this series, all details are in their show notes. We're proud to be playing a small part in the journey of these fabulous founders. So let's talk on to walk on with Rebecca, Paul, and Peter, and let's see where it leads. Okay, well, we'll have to open with welcoming Peter to our Talk On To Walk On podcast, and also to our home, because you're in our office. It's a long story, but we welcome you to our house, and I can't wait for you to share your story. And we're just going to dive in, as I've done with all the Baltic Ventures cohort, and start with how your business, Burl, is looking to revolutionize the fashion brand industry, and how you are going to unlock apparently 2 trillion of idle branded items in our wardrobe. Is that right, Peter?
Well, no pressure at all. I think what we're really trying to do is, you know, our motto is make better easier, really. So it's trying to get both brands and customers engaged in being better. And the way we're doing that is creating a really easy to adopt solution for brands to add onto their sites, to encourage their customers to trade in existing and old product when they buy new, essentially. So it's almost like every time you buy something new, give something up that you'll get credit for that someone else can use, rather than it laying idle in your wardrobe. And then that's where that sort of value of 2 trillion comes from, where people aren't using those items, and therefore we're making new, and actually there's so much stuff that's unused, as it were.
You can't knock that idea when it comes to the environment and sustainability and all those important issues. But talk us through what that actually looks like talk us through the steps of, for example, I have a load of Let's Manifest Adidas shoes, trainers in my wardrobe. I can't quite afford another pair, though I've got my eye on a pair. And I also feel a bit guilty about all the stuff that I'm collating.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So essentially, you go on a brand website, in that case, the Adidas website. And as you're sort of near the add to cart button, you'd see Burl and the ability to trade in products that you've previously purchased. And there's two ways of trading it in. You can either trade it in via trading portal. So you can trade in anything that's been bought by other retailers. So let's say you've bought it from JD or any of the other big retailers. And you can go that way and get a set credit per category. Or the sort of more sophisticated and exciting part is you can log into your existing Adidas account and trade in directly from there. And then that will give you a credit based on exactly what you've paid for it. So you can give brands the option of giving a more meaningful credit for customers, because they know exactly what the item is that's coming back. And then the more exciting thing for you as a customer is that you'll get that credit immediately. So you can spend immediately before you even send the item back. And the way that we do that is we're pre-authorizing card details so that if you don't send the item back or you send the wrong item back or what have you, we'll just recharge you for the credit or a portion of the credit that you've received. But the big feedback we've had in our sort of market research is that for consumers to move away from other methods, they've got to get that credit immediately because they can't get the immediate credit from eBay or Vinted or what have you. And for brands to sort of really engage with this, they want that conversion immediately. They don't want you going away, waiting for your credit, and then finding out that you've got another bill or something else that you want to purchase and therefore you'd never purchase as it were. So it's all about that immediacy for both the customer and the brand.
And that's yeah. Very different to some of the other sort of upcycling, recycling of fashion type businesses that I've read about, because if I'm right in saying you're focusing on the brand, so you're encouraging people to go to the website of the brand rather than the retailer, and that must be great for the brand too.
Exactly, yeah. So for people that sort of are less familiar with retail, a brand makes roughly double the margin by selling directly to the customer than they do through their wholesale retail network. So every time you buy directly from, let's say, Adidas again, they'll make double the margin if they sold it to JD Sports and then you bought through JD Sports. So every time the brand can encourage a customer to shop directly is a massive win for them, and hence why direct to consumer e-commerce has been such an in vogue thing in the last sort of 10 years, as it were.
And you do hear about, as well as witnessing firsthand, people who have tons and tons of clothes and shoes in their wardrobe, which are in great condition, but are hardly worn. So it's a little bit of a nudge, isn't it? It's like nudge economics, where you're sort of nudging people to say, well, instead of going through all the hassle of taking a photograph of it and putting it on Vinted and then waiting to see if it sells and adjusting the price and all of that hassle, you can just click on Burl, you know, if it's a brand that you want to continue buying and you've got branded stuff in your wardrobe, and hey presto, you're done.
Exactly, yeah. It's one of our big sort of activations we're looking to do in the next few months is to integrate with email comms so that you'll receive an email 6 months or 12 months or 2 years down the line after you've bought something to just say, are you still using that? Because if not, you know, trade in for credit. So it's just a really easy way of going, oh, you know what, I do really want that dress or that pair of trousers, what have you. I'm not using something and I have it for credit, rather than sort of having to think about it. And I think the other thing that's really interesting in this space is the emphasis is all on the seller at the moment, and sellers can't be bothered, whereas buyers are quite happy to look for things and try and search for things. You know, think about like the used car market. You know, you'll try and find that exact color that you want or that exact trim or what have you. And you put effort into it. And I think it's about trying to move away from the onus being on the seller and then moving it towards the buyer. And I think we'll get a lot more traction in that space. So we've got a few ideas, sort of customer to customer ideas, and turning brands into marketplaces and things like that, where we put the emphasis on the buyer rather than the seller. And I think that's really where the end goal is, as it were, rather than that is it at the moment.
So where are you now in terms of attracting those brands? What are you having conversations? Have you converted? Where are you now?
Weirdly, we're in a lucky position because we have a brand ready to go. We've got a fantastic brand which are called Lavenham, which they make everything in the UK. So it's a really good fit for us. Their sort of slogan is be better. And it's a lovely fit for us, and they've got an award-winning website, so the products can look amazing, what have you. Just getting live, we'll hopefully be live in the next 1 to 2 weeks, but we're in London yesterday to speak with a another really good brand who are based on Savile Row, and really exciting British brand that's making a lot of waves in the US and Japan, a bit bigger as well, which is really exciting. And we've had probably 5 or 6 other really good demos, and people are just waiting to see it live and go from there. So in a really exciting but really frustrating position at the moment, because we just want to get going and get that traction. I feel like that's where we'll do better, as sort of in life, as it were, rather than the pre-life stage of a startup.
That frustration is very common, isn't it? When you're just ready to go and you're waiting for that breakthrough. Every entrepreneur who has a success story always remembers those moments. And it's in those moments where, obviously, I'm not going to talk about giving up, but it's in those moments you've got to hold strong, haven't you? And really stay true to what you've worked on and what you believe in. How is your mindset around that?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, we've been through that the last few weeks of just sort of saying, what can we control and what can we do the best on that we can control? So we're like, what are the really rubbish jobs that we can do now before we're live that we might not have time to do? So one thing we've been working really hard on is sort of automating our sales funnel so that when we go live, we can do that, you know, a lot larger scale. So I've been very familiar with HubSpot recently, and just social media, just trying to find everything. But we've got, you know, 600 brands now and an average of 4 or 5 contacts per brand, you know, ready to go. We've got all their LinkedIn profiles. So we've made a load of progress on that. So I think in answer to your question, you know, as you know, less associated with what we're doing, but just in general, I think it's controlling the things that are in your control, and just also turning up every day and being repetitive and just saying, look, we're going to move it forward as much as we can. And then as soon as we're ready to go, like, you know, we all that foundational work will push us forward quicker, if you know what I mean.
What is it across the big brands? Because you would think that this is right up their street. Is it just general inertia in the industry that is preventing them from absolutely, you know, getting excited and adopting, you know, Burl's product? Or is it just because they're large organizations and everything takes, you know, a long time to make any sort of fundamental changes?
Yeah, great question. I think the sort of stigma around secondhand has definitely changed a lot. So we're getting a lot of progress there. I'd say sort of 2020, 2021, we've seen a bit more progress in the States with the bigger brands. So Levi's and the North Face and Patagonia and the sort of brands you'd expect to now have resale programs in the States. But fundamentally, I think the biggest sort of sticking point for a lot of brands is just what happens to that product. They don't want markets that they're unaware of to be flooded with product that, you know, and all the rest of it. And, you know, part of what we're trying to build is that transparency from end to end, so we can say exactly where that product ended up. You'll have seen probably in the press recently of, you know, being able to see piles of clothing in the Atacama Desert from space or products ending up on beaches in Africa and what have you. And a lot of brands are conscious of the fact that there are murky players in the background who are just pushing the problem elsewhere. Until they can really get that transparency of what's happening with the product, I think they're a little bit worried about their sort of brand reputation, as it were.
And you've got a zero to landfill guarantee, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah. So we work with a marketplace called Market to sell everything that's resellable. It's fantastic. They take such. We were up there in Easing World near York a few weeks ago. They take such pride in everything they do. If everything can't be sold, we look at upcycling it. So looking at, let's say, taking a jacket, making it into a dog jacket or anything like that. That's sort of our big next stage is to do that. And there's some brilliant partners out there like Greater Goods and a lot of individual sort of artisan partners who can do things like that. And then at that point, we then work at sort of breaking the remaining product down into different options. We'd love to get to fiber to fiber where we can turn it back into yarn for clothing, but at the moment there is some really good solutions about turning it into cleaning products or wall insulation and things like that, so the product's still used, doesn't end up in landfill, and we can get to that point where at least everything's used rather than it going to waste, as it were.
And is there a reward for the customer the more they do it? Is there an incentive other than the environmental, you're doing good for the planet incentive?
Yeah, the brand we were talking to yesterday were really keen on that, actually, of offering sort of VIP benefits for people that do it more often. And I think as we sort of develop it, we might have our own Burl app where we can offer more for sort of people that are doing it more often and unlock different benefits. But for sure, yeah, that's definitely something we're looking at once we've gone live and get going.
Amazing. This isn't your first business though, is it, Peter? What lessons did you learn from the last one? Tell us about that.
Yeah, good question. I think people like in life are what makes life and good and bad. And I think, you know, you've got to be surrounded by the right people. I wasn't. I really got took advantage of. I started when I was 25. I took on some help and some resource and what have you. And and it's a really weird one, really, in terms of it. You grew the business really well, you know, with no external investment. You know, went from pre-revenue to sort of 2 million revenue. Did lots of good things, had lots of success, but ended up leaving the business because it wasn't good for me anymore. I was in over Christmas with my, I think, 1-year-old daughter at the time, and my wife came in and said, you haven't actually spoken to her in the last 40 minutes. Like, you haven't actually even said anything. And I realized sort of how bad a place I was in at that time in terms of how negative it was having an impact on myself. So I've always had this ethos of, like, there's no point of being in a room on your own surrounded by money with no one to share it. So, you know, I was like, well, I don't want to lose the things that are most important to me. So I decided to step away and start again. So I moved away to work for an organization, and then realized that that wasn't really for me. So I needed to start something again. So yeah, but just on a different foot as well.
But what a powerful moment, even though it's probably one that made you wanted the ground to swallow you up at the time. It's actually that moment when your wife was brave enough to say it to you. It gave you a real kick, didn't it? To really appreciate what's important in life, but actually how you're going to then work on the balance of being motivated to achieve the dream of being a successful entrepreneur and provide for your family, but also making sure that you have time for them.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I don't regret the decision. It was one of the best, probably the best decision I've ever made. Every month I've had since has been better than the years I've had previously. And you realize what's important, and success has come as a result, really, in terms of lots of different ways. And most importantly, I just feel a better person and a better parent as a result. And, you know, that's what drives me. You know, very lucky to have had two amazing parents myself, and to be in a loving household. And I just realized the value of that, and without that, then I don't think the rest is possible, as it were. So it's really important for my children that they have a father that's engaged, if you know.
Yeah.
And I think that I've got no basis in stats to support what I'm about to say, but I think that the idea I think it's far more common for people who have jobs with companies as employees than thinking, oh, I could set up my own business, and set up their own business, struggle and find it difficult, and come back into the workplace as an employee and realize that maybe they're not so entrepreneurial as they thought. But with you, it's the opposite, isn't it? So you know, you tried to go into get a normal job being employed, and thought, and there was something, a scratch that needed itching, for you to then say, no, I want to go back into being an entrepreneur. Where you just talked about your family. Where do you think that comes from, that drive and that entrepreneurial spirit?
Yeah, definitely. My mum is an absolute superstar. So, like, my parents are both optometrists. Have always had their own practice for 30-odd years. And my mum's done all the business side of things outside of the optometry as well. She still does, actually. She doesn't see anyone see any patients anymore, but she does all that side of it. So definitely from her. That obviously they've been entrepreneurial, but not fully entrepreneurial, because obviously there's still sort of a lot of clinical side of it as well. But it's weird, my brothers are both teachers. My family are all very much employed, so they were outliers, you know, and I guess I've taken it from them. But I think there is always that inherent nature part of it as well. Some people just aren't made to sort of fit into an organization, and they realize they need to do their own thing as well.
And we'll come on to your business partner, Cam, in a minute. But in those moments, who is it that you think, should I go? You probably don't think, should I ever go back into the corporate world or whatever? But if you had a wobble, who would it be that you would talk to about that? And has that ever happened?
I'm lucky that, you know, I've got, you know, I'm not actually someone who surrounds myself with many people, but the people I do surround myself with are really useful. So ironically, actually, both my brothers would be really helpful in that. But, you know, my wife and my mum would be really helpful. And I've got a couple of good friends as well in terms of that way, but for me, sort of key advice comes from family, I think, rather than friends. Family always there, aren't they? Whether they like you or not, they'll always put up with you. So
are you good at opening up, Peter?
I don't know, you know. I think I'm good at listening to other people, but I don't know if I'm always good at discussing my own problems. But I have learned from previous sort of, you know the need to open up, as it were, compared to sort of previous generations. But there's always improvement, isn't it? I think it's about sort of owning when you've got it wrong and trying to be better. But I'm better in my 30s than I was in my 20s, but hopefully I'll be better in my 40s than I was in my 30s.
Yeah, that's actually a very, really good point. So your business partner, tell us about him and how that all came about.
Yeah, sure. So one of the great things of working at that organization was that Cam was there, and we got on really well, and both of us, he had that itch to scratch that he'd never been able to scratch, and we sort of aligned, and an opportunity came to sort of do Burl, and he massively helped me as well. When I was leaving what I was doing previously, I reached out to him to Cam to work and to sort of say, where would I fit into a tech organization? It was always that side of e-commerce, and that I'd always had more time for, rather than sort of the buying and selling of goods. And he said, oh, you'd be in a product role and what have you. We actually need someone with your experience at the moment in the organization in Sorted that we were working in. So he did me a massive favor to give me that sort of chance. And it's just gone full circle. And we decided that we were going to work together and do something together that we both knew that we needed to do and wanted to do. And I think also both of us have got small children, and we wanted to build something that was positive as well. But in a commercial way, you know, I think it is a balance between, you know, building something for something's sake, but it never actually is any use or it's never sustainable, and actually building something that is commercially beneficial for both brands and customers. And then you feel like there's a real growth and exit plan there. You can do something properly, tangibly good, if you know what I mean.
So there's a conversation that you've had that's changed your life. You know, you recognized something in Cam that you knew that you were drawn to, and he's seen something in you, and now you're trying to change the world together. It's brilliant. Do you have complementary skills, or do you clash, or how does that
work? Yeah, good question. I think that was one of the reasons why we started together, as we knew we had different experience and different skills. There's always times we disagree, right? And I think it'd be wrong if we didn't, because we wouldn't really be that passionate about what we're doing if we just sort of let each other get on with it. We definitely have complementary skills. And as we build out a team, we're very much about bringing in skills that we don't have as well. You know, it's very easy to bring in people to do things you don't want to do, and what we're trying to do is bring in people who can do things better than us, and that's sort of the area. So very much now Cam's now more on the sort of investment and stakeholder management and all those sort of elements, and I'm more look after sort of products and sales. So we've just in the last few weeks sort of moved stuff out just because of how much work there is now to do, and just trying to understand how we can reach full capacity, as it were, whereas before we used to do a lot more together.
I like the Peter. I liked on your LinkedIn, I think it was this week, and you have a weekly high five, I think that you call it, and you had something on there it was the quote about if you want to go fast, go alone, and if you want to go far, go together. And I assume that you can use that quote when you're talking about your co-founder.
I believe it's an African phrase that there's actually a fantastic running club in the Baltic Triangle called, I'm going to get it wrong now, I think it's Two Step Collective. And it's all about sort of social running and the idea of that if you do things together, then you'll run more and you'll be better. And they've got this lovely mural in the Baltic, which is the picture that I took of people running together. I very much believe that, like, you know, we can all do so much, and maybe in a quicker time frame on our own. But the power of the team and the collective is amazing, really. You know, 10 people working together is like 100 people working apart, right? So I think it's so important that we stick together and don't forget that end goal of trying to build something that's really meaningful and change the world, hopefully.
It's interesting in the episodes that we've done with your fellow sort of cohort in Baltic Ventures, there seems to be a universal agreement that having a co-founder is absolutely crucial, and trying to go alone as a founder, a solo founder, is so far more difficult.
Definitely, I can speak testament to that. That was what I did the first time, and you know, and it's not about just output; it's about those days where you're having a bad time and the other person brings you up. And also, if there's two of you, the likeliness of one of you is having a good day to move things forward, it is so much more likely. I saw this article the other day about, will AI get rid of co-founders, that, you know, you can get rid of a lot of the admin to a second person. But I really don't think that's what it's about. I think it's about that collective of, you know, teamwork, bringing it together, you know, dragging each other along, and, you know, no one gets left behind, sort of thing. And I think that's that, you know, why I think a co-founder is so important. And you see why so many VCs and what have you will only invest in co-founding teams, but I think that's because they just stick at it a bit longer. They can just go for a bit longer. In you get some amazing people that can do it on their own, but you know, hats off to them, because I think it's a lot easier doing it together.
Mm. Yeah, it's a bit of, I was talking to somebody there, and she's been stung. It's somebody we mentor, and by a co-founder. They were on the very early days of the business, and they've now parted ways, and now she's very much never again, never again. And it is just, she's got to be brave and keep her eyes open, and but it's about building that trust. It does take time, doesn't it? And I know she's in a hurry. So it's hard, isn't it, to be brave and take that step and seek out a co-founder or do it alone. But I do think if it works, it's pretty priceless, and you create memories together as well as building the business.
Definitely, you need that trust. I mean, you see them more than you see your actual partner, right? So in terms of, like, you know, you really need to trust them inherently. And actually, you know, you talked about skill set before. I think your moral set is probably the most important thing, in terms of, like, you both got to agree what's right and what you're prepared to do and what you're not. And then go from there in terms of, are you complementary as, you know, business partners or founders or what have you. But yeah, trust is massive. I think without that, you'd be constantly looking over your shoulder about what the other one wants to do and what have you. And
how has the Baltic Ventures experience been for you from a business growth perspective and a collaborative perspective?
I mean, from partnerships angle, we've had all sorts of great stuff. We've had some brilliant agencies and partners and opportunities as a result of it, and that's been fantastic. From investment side of things, been really progressive as well. And then also just sort of simplification of what we're doing is, I think, a big part of startups and something that gets overlooked, in terms of, like, it's very easy. And we still struggle, right? I still struggle of, like, how do I explain Burl to someone who doesn't know what we're doing? And I think all that sort of value proposition and product market fit and all those elements are really, really helpful to be part of an accelerator. And then it also, that togetherness, as you say, of, like, you know, there's other people that are struggling like you. You know, I think, you know, when you're struggling to get investment or struggling to get that first brand or what have you, to have 9 others or 8 others in the cohort that are all having the same problems, it really makes you realize that actually, you know, especially in this environment, it's not easy, and you need to just keep going and turning up and what have you. And, you know, and you can all lean on each other to do well. And this, again, there's other people with different skills to you. So it's all about making sure you turn up and learn as well. That's the big thing for me. There's some people out there, like Thomas, on, you know, amazing at sales and outreach and putting their, you know, his CTO brand out there. I've learned loads of him. He's a great example. I'm naturally sort of more introverted, so just trying to sort of put myself out there and do that sort of thing is something that I'm really trying to embrace, and what he's done. He's been so helpful and so generous with his time as well. So yeah, it's really good people, but I think the togetherness is probably the main thing that we got out of it.
And I know, Peter, that I think you call yourself an adopted Scouser. But I read, you mentioned that one of the reasons why you were so happy to be joining the Baltic Accelerator was that, you know, it's based here in Liverpool in the Northwest, and being an adopted Scouser, and by the way, I'm also an honorary Scouser.
Is that like a promotion?
To adopt it, I don't know which comes first. Yeah, work harder, Peter. You'll soon become an honorary Scouser. But it was important for you to be doing something for the region and giving back, and that part of what Burl is all about was important, and that connection with the Baltic Accelerator was important to you.
100%. Yeah, I live in Liverpool myself, and I went to the University of Manchester, met my wife in the University of Manchester. I came out and I struggled for job opportunities within the Northwest that I thought were aligned with what I wanted. I wanted to think big and to be at the top end of you know, what organizers are doing and be innovative and what have you. And that was a big reason why I ended up going into sort of being an entrepreneur at 25, is I didn't see a lot of the job opportunities that I wanted in the Northwest. But I haven't forgotten that. And I think it's really important that people have opportunities in the Northwest, and that there's exciting things to drive people up here. There's so much going for the region. And if we can just create a reason for people to stay in Liverpool post university, or, you know, or people who are from Liverpool to not leave, you know, it's massive. And we've just employed someone who's from Liverpool, spent 10 years in London, and we've given them a reason to come back to live in Liverpool and be where they want to be. And that's really exciting for me. That's fantastic. You know, everyone that we've employed so far is based in Liverpool. And you know, it's about creating that hub. I look at what like Gymshark has done for Birmingham and creating that hub and creating that example. And if you don't have a pioneer or a leader, others can't follow and see that it's possible. And I think that's really what we're trying to do at Bird, is say, look, it is really possible to set up here. There's lots of advantages of doing so. It's actually a really naturally innovative place. I think Scousers as a whole are quite an innovative community. Like, you know, everyone's got a side hustle, everyone's doing this, everyone knows a little trick that no one else knows, what have you, and all those sort of bits and bobs. And I think, you know, if we can create more business and innovation here, I think that's a really exciting thing for the city, and the city lends itself to it, as it were.
You know what, Peter? I'm just going to say thank you, because I feel a little bit emotional, actually, because that was one of the big factors for us to invest in Baltic. You know, that everything that you've just said, and the fact that you're saying that you're already employing people that are from here, it's like a massive... I feel it, honestly. We don't we? Mm. It's exactly the outcome that we were looking for, by being investors in the Baltic Ventures. So thank you for that. You mentioned Gymshark, and you're now employing people. How does that make you feel? Are you conscious that you've now got to create a culture to keep them people happy and part of the Bale brand?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it is. It definitely is ramped up in terms of responsibility. I mean, like, I look at stakeholders, you know, within our business, and staff are number one, but like above us, you know, like, you know, if there's only enough for either us or them, it'll always be them. So in terms of, you know, it's very much they have to be central to what we do. It's difficult, isn't it? I think in this world of sort of remote first and not having office spaces and all the rest of it, how you sort of create that culture and enable it. And I think transparency is a big part of that, of really just trying to explain, this is what we're trying to do, you're part of this. You know, I very much view Burl as ours as a team rather than ours as Cam and mine, and try and do that. But I think we're gonna have a big challenge, right? You know, it's difficult to keep people engaged and what have you. And I think it's just about listening and trying to understand what's really important for them and trying to answer their needs as best as possible in the most financially realistic way as possible. That's the problem, isn't it? Some people have needs that just aren't really answerable. So we're just gonna hopefully be able to align ourselves with people that are prepared to bear with us as we sort of grow as well, I think.
Yeah.
And you talked about you know, the challenges of remote working and Michelle's question about building a culture. I also remember you saying that and of course you've got your kids at home to think about, and Cam's got his kids as well. And I remember reading something you said that you developed quite a unique working routine to cope with all of that. Tell us more about that, because I don't know, there was no explanation to go with it. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I think there's five areas of life, right? So there's work, family, recreation, sleep, and exercise. They're like the five key areas, right? And I don't think you can prioritize all of those five, unfortunately, especially when you have children. So my routine is I used to give up exercise, and I think that's non-negotiable for me, for my sort of mental health. So I now pretty much sleep in a very strange way. So I basically, so I work normally from, so like I'll get the kids up half six, work half seven till nine, or commute, what have you, work till five. And then I always take time out then to make sure the kids like bath, go to bed, what have you. And then I spend 2 hours with my wife at sort of 7 till 9, 8 till 10, depending on how it works out. And then I then work from that time till 2 in the morning.
Oh, bless.
And then I start again at 6, because I know that no one will bother me at that time, so I can get the most done. But I do little cheats. So like I might go back to bed when the kids go back to school, just go to school or what have you. So like, I might have 6:30 to 7:30. I might fall asleep with my little boy, so I have an hour then, generally, until I try and put it out there. But fundamentally, when work's hard or work's tough, I'll go till 2 every day. And you get used to it, it's fine. You get, you know, and I like it because I know that for whatever reason, I'm productive at that time. I can get going and no one else bothers me. So yeah, problem is I eat a lot of rubbish food at that time. That's the big negative. It's like, it's very hard to keep going without sort of being on the Haribos, as it were. So yeah, that's
the negative. Was that one of your five, nutrition or
no? Well, yeah, that's why I haven't included it, I think. I couldn't not account for it.
And your wife gets the starfish in the bed.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, there's no space anyway. The kids are always in the bed.
So there you go. Oh, I mean, that sounds pretty tough, but it is it's the reality of being driven, focused. You know, you are on the cusp of huge things, which, you know, it's coming, and you're at a really crucial point in your business, aren't you? So is that sacrifice of your sleep and or mixing up your routine, do you see it as a sacrifice, or do you see it as something that you will retain?
I don't know. I don't think it's healthy long term, but yeah, very much like, you know, you have to be good. You have to just, you know, to be good at something, you have to be able to do something that other people aren't prepared to do, right? Or at least match them. So, you know, the easiest thing to do is put more effort in, right? You know, whether you're you know, more talented or more lucky or what have you, you know, I think all of that comes from effort, right? And, you know, you see that with the best athletes in the world or the best minds or what have you. And that's just my effort to know that when I do go to sleep, I can feel happy that I've given it my best every day. And that's not a Monday to Friday thing either, by the way. That's like, I do that at least one day on the weekend as well. So it just becomes a normality. But I think habit becomes easier, if you know what I mean.
There is actually a saying you just reminded me, is it is that be prepared to do today what others aren't prepared to do, to have tomorrow what others won't have. So
hopefully the second bit comes true.
And it, something good will come out of it, I promise you. Whatever it is, and it will be Burl, because we know that that's going to happen for you, and it's happening already. But it is the realities of being an entrepreneur. It's not easy, is it? And I know you've talked about peacocking on, you know, some tech leaders sort of get on your nerves a little bit when you look around the startup tech landscape. Tell us about that and what your thoughts are around that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a dangerous space, tech, because people expect to be funded, and people need to be funded, right? Because for lots of reasons, but, you know, things are expensive to build, you know, so that's the case. But coming from like a proper bootstrapped e-commerce business where like you spend your own money, you know, you do things that get you to the next stage, you know, organically. And I think a lot of people are doing things and saying things because they think that it'll attract investment or make them look really good, rather than making their business better, which will then actually attract the investment. So I guess my big frustration is all about people who say what they're going to do rather than talk about what they've done. And, you know, and that's just such a toxic place to be in, really, because you're like, all you ever do is say you're going to do things, and inevitably you're just lying to yourself that you know, rather than anyone else. So I guess from my side of it, it's just sort of like, strip it back. If there was no investors involved, if there was no glamour involved, there was no awards involved, what would you do to make your business better? And if you do that, all the rest of it will come, you know, it will naturally, people will be attracted to you. Like, you speak about, do you know the ice cream man Halo Top, that like the really low calorie Halo Top ice cream man? But like, he like transformed ice cream in the States, and like, he just, people like having find his address and knock on his door trying to invest in him because he's doing such a good job. Do you know what I mean? And I know that's an extreme case, but like, rather than just think I need to do all this stuff for investment, do the stuff right and it will come. Do you know what I mean? I think just everyone's looking at, well, not everyone, some people are looking at things back to front as well. I think,
interesting take.
Unfortunately, there is a history of people who you think are clever and should know what they're doing actually falling for some of the hype and the hyperbole that comes out of people who are maybe ambitious beyond the ambition they should really have. Is that your experience? Do these types get found out?
Well, you've got that amazing use case of Theranos, right, with Elizabeth Holmes.
That's like, probably the extremist example.
I think you will get found out at some point now. I think, you know, there's so much data on everything. There's so much visibility of what you're doing. But equally, to your first part of the question, people are definitely being brought along for the ride. You know, there are some really good storytellers that are getting people to invest and what have you as a result. So I think both sides, I think, need to be a little bit more conscious. But I think it's hard to explain, but I think even when, you know, as a founder, when you're looking at an investor, if you get a bad feeling they're not aligned with you, be prepared to make that tough decision to not take the money. Like, you know, in terms of, it's really hard to do that. And I've made the mistake of doing that with my first business. But a month or so of pain of trying to find out a way of paying the mortgage is a lot better than having 5-6 years of dealing with someone you don't want to speak to every single day. So, you know, in terms of, you know, and that's, you know, it could be longer than that, right? So yeah, it very much, if you get a bad inkling, just stay away, because it, it, you're, I think it was part of my high five as well, as you know, your hunch is made up of a lifetime of experience, right? So you know your hunch is usually right most of the time. So you know, if you feel really bad about something, it's probably for the right reasons.
Yeah, trust your gut, definitely. I love that. Coming on to your, I'm going to tell you, we had a chat when you arrived here about a certain person who I like go to jelly when we speak, and it's not you. It's not Patrick, and he knows exactly who it is.
I know it's not me.
And because we've been asking the cohort about the inspirational leaders, and you may have a particular business one, but we did talk about, and I have to bring him up, Jürgen Klopp.
Why is this your jelly? Is it?
Yeah, and they say don't meet your heroes, but I met him and I did go to jelly. So, tell us about why you love him.
I just think for someone to come into this city who's not even from the UK and bring people together and give people hope like he has, it's just absolutely amazing. Like, I just think the way that he's managed to get people to hope again. I mean, like we're all in a really privileged position, right? You know, we all, you know, work on stuff we want to, but imagine, you know, you're going to warehouse every morning, you know what I mean, and you know there's not many job opportunities for yourself, or even worse, you might not have a job, right? And Liverpool is your religion, right? You know, in terms of you, that's the thing that you get up for every day, and that man has given hope to those people, and over a long period of time, and he's just behaved impeccably. Like, you know, he's never, you know, I know he has jokes about things, what have you, but you know, he's always stood up, he's always shown passion, and the reason why he's leaving, right, is because he doesn't feel like he can give 100% anymore, and that's just massive. Like to be able to look yourself in the mirror and go, I can't give 100% of myself anymore, like that's so transparent, so powerful. So I just have so much time for him because he brings people together that wouldn't be brought together in any other way, and he just gives people hope, and I think we all need hope, right? We're living in a relatively dark world at the moment, unfortunately, and you know, to have that thing that gives people a reason to get up in the morning and enjoy their weekends or whatever, you know, is massive. And we all know how big LFC is for Liverpool, and you know, as a city, and you know, and there's been some dark times, right, for LFC, and you know, and he's brought that back, and I just think that's, yeah, I can't thank him enough. I think he just makes the city a better place, and I just hope that he decides that he can give it more and stays for another 20 years, because yeah, it'd be a better situation. Yeah.
But yeah, everything you've said there is just, again, what we bang on about, isn't it, when we talk about Sinton.
especially you.
Me, yeah. No, I just, he's my, I'm my, you will manifest Adidas for Burl, and let's manifest Jürgen Klopp for Talk On To Walk On, because what a dream guest he would be. But he's definitely on the vision board, only as a guest. Yeah.
We went to a match at Anfield, and we went to lots of matches. I know, but we went to one particular one where there was Daniel Craig in the stand, about 100 yards away, and then there was Jürgen Klopp down in the dugout, and of course, yeah,
I
could have been invisible. I was.
Are we going to close up with our quick fire? Did we ask you how you switched off? Is it running?
Running, yeah. I'd like the runner's high is great. Like, yeah, if you when you put it in and you get it at the end and you just feel those endorphins going, definitely big thing. But anything with the ball, I'll watch. So you know, that very much helps. So yeah, in terms of anything that involves ball sport, I'll happily participate or watching as well. So yeah, so yeah.
So will you give me a sneak preview? Because I know in your high five, you're trying to run 200 kilometers in Lent. And last week you had got to 37 out of the 200. So yeah, when you post later on tonight, are you allowed to tell us now? Because I guess the podcast episode isn't going to be coming out tonight. So tell us now how many kilometers you've done.
Yeah, good question. I think I'm up to just about 80. I did 16K the day before yesterday. Oh, so I'm doing the St. Helens 10K on Sunday. So so I should be not far off 100 by the time I finish off that. But I can't give you an exact figure. I should have prepped beforehand.
That's okay.
And just before we come to the Dragon's Den or apprentice question, what is the dream for Peter? What does, I know you say you don't like looking forward too much, but if, you know, when we get you back on Talk On To Walk On in a few years' time.
Yeah, sure. I think I was given one objective by my parents, which was to give my children the same opportunities they gave me. So that's the overriding thing. I would love freedom to work on what I want, and also freedom to live where I want. And apart from that, I do nothing really. Sort of, they're the three things, I think. So
that's brilliant. So, Dragon's Den or apprentice?
more of a Dragon's Den. I don't like the hype side of things. I think The Apprentice probably doesn't align with that. So definitely Dragon's Den. And it's really nice to see those lads from Formby on it the other day, Lux Collective, and they've done really well. So shout out to them. Good on them. And hopefully we can maybe work with them soon once we enter a few different markets. So yeah, Dragon's Den.
Yeah, that would be great. Do you know the guys there? Have you
met them? No, don't at all. But I just love what they've done, and I love the power that they've brought with social media. So I just think it's great. Like, you know, stick to what you're good at, and you know, and keep going at it. And they've done a good job. So,
but thinking about it, I'm not telling you what to do, but I guess you've thought that they. I'm guessing they would fit quite well with Berlin.
Yeah, so they're more aligned with luxury at the moment, but definitely in terms of for us as we move into that luxury run sort of premium space, could be really good fit. And we've got a few ideas that they can maybe help us with in terms of we'd like to use tech that allows secondhand to be sold across multiple marketplaces at once, and it would need like a sort of process to do that. So someone with their experience might be a massive help in that. So yeah, definitely like to if they're watching this or what have you, it'd be great to speak to them and have a chat.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, definitely shout out to them. That will definitely happen. There's no doubt about that. So in terms of you're in the process of still raising finance. Is there a call to action for you're looking for investors?
Yeah, I probably haven't shared the good news actually. We just I can't say exactly what it is because we're under embargo, but we've just raised. Oh, so we've just been successful in getting a £350,000 grant off the government to sort of add some AI and machine learning into what we're doing, which is really exciting. So we're in to win that or secure that, we have to match that with private funding. So we're about half the way there at the moment. So yeah, we'd love to get to that point, and then we can really just crack on and move with that sort of £700,000 runway, which will be massive for us because we'll be revenue generating as soon as we go live, and we're relatively capital efficient really because we're sort of the glue. We don't have a lot of overhead really. So so for us that's massive and gives us the chance to focus on Baal rather than focus on raising money. So yeah, that's what we're doing at the moment.
Congratulations.
So if people want to get in touch and be part of that, part of the Baal story, is it through LinkedIn or the website? What's the best way to get hold of Peter and Cam?
Yeah, we'll take any inquiries, any format. but cam@wearebaal.com or peter@wearebaal.com is probably the best. Obviously, well, LinkedIn's great, but yeah, we're wherever you can find us, we'll answer. We're very much active on everything that we're there for, and happy to speak to anyone and explain a little bit more what we're doing.
Great. Well, we'll put all the with all the cohort, put all the details in the show notes, and you know, we'll be sharing some of this on social media as well, and so there'll be plenty of opportunities for people to find those links and connect with you. So, what a brilliant story, Peter. We're both really excited, aren't we, to be part of the Baal story and the Baltic Ventures cohort 2023. So it's great.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And Baal's business in particular is something which is going to change. It's one of those big societal changes that's needed. So it's really, really exciting to hear you describe what you're up to. And we're really looking forward to following you on your journey. So thank you.
Thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you guys and for making me feel so welcome. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Take care.